This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, top experts, 28 minutes, and a big issue of the day. Let's go. This week, by train. HS2, England's high-speed rail project, will deliver a new anatomy of British transport, according to the Prime Minister. But there are predictions this week that a third of it will be put on hold. So what's the point of HS2? This week, there were reports that the government is planning to mothball a major part of the massive HS2 project, the plan for a high-speed railway linking London with the north. For cost reasons, the bit going from the Midlands to Yorkshire may be delayed, perhaps forever. But huge enterprises like this are never just about the upfront cost. They're about politics, status, regional sensibilities, and economic development. So what exactly is happening with HS2, and is it worth it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's recall why we embarked on HS2 in the first place and how much of it has already been built. Nick Kingsley is managing editor of Railway Gazette International. Nick Kingsley, how and when did the idea for a new national high-speed rail network come about?
As the early years of the new millennium came into view, it was becoming increasingly clear that rail passenger numbers were going up very strongly, and there were mounting capacity challenges, certainly on the West Coast Main Line, but also on several of the other strategic north-south routes, and also at several of the key city hubs, thinking of places like Birmingham New Street and Manchester Piccadilly. So there was a series of kind of reports, and then we had a government white paper in 2007 called Delivering a Sustainable Railway, which also said there could be a case for planning new lines. And then we had the Labour government of the late 2000s, well, the Transport Secretary in 2009, Jeff Hoon, asked Lord Andrew Adonis to start formal work on a kind of a white paper looking at the potential for a new high-speed rail route. And that filtered through to a white paper in 2010, which essentially set out the Y network for HS2.
My understanding is that HS2 was planned in three phases. Can you just quickly take us through what the three phases are?
It's not totally straightforward, but you've got phase one, which is London to Birmingham and Lichfield. And at Lichfield, there'll be a junction with the existing West Coast line. Phase 2A, which is Lichfield up to Crewe. And phase 2B, which has two halves. So phase 2B, Western leg, goes from Crewe to Manchester and Crewe to Wigan. And phase 2B eastern leg goes from broadly the Lichfield area up to Leeds and also to a junction with the existing network just south of York.
Let's go back to the original plans for the full thing. What was it expected to cost when it was first put forward and embarked upon?
The 2010 white paper cost was, for the whole Y network, was £33 billion. That has obviously gone up substantially since then. The Okavy review into how and whether to proceed with HS2, which was published in February last year, put the net cost to the transport budget between £62 and £69 billion for the Y network.
Which is roughly double the original budget. So why the difference?
I think there are a number of really significant caveats to put on the budget question. First of all, HS2's been approved through a slightly arcane parliamentary process called a hybrid bill. And the railway that was in the original hybrid bill for phase one, which is London, Birmingham, Lichfield, was the railway plan that went into Parliament and the railway plan that came out of Parliament with approval at the end of the hybrid bill process were quite different. So, for example, there was significantly more tunnelling added to the project. And as we know, the route out of London passes through relatively rural and also relatively affluent parts of the country. And as we all know, there's been significant opposition, and I think that fed through into the hybrid bill process. The second issue is that there's been questions raised over the government's procurement model for the construction of HS2, which is perceived to have transferred an unusually large amount of risk onto the private contractors who are going to be building this railway. And by risk, I mean things like guarantees over movement of earthworks over a 25 to 30 year period. And my understanding is that these assumptions are significantly more onerous than previous major rail projects. And I've seen some reports suggesting this may have added a third to the cost of the of phase one. And thirdly, this railway's got to run for, let's say, between 60 and 120 years at least, and maybe more. So there are decisions that have been made at the construction stage that will add cost in construction, but significantly save cost every day that the railway is running.
Right. Now, when were the various stages of the original plan expected to be completed?
The original hope was that the first phase between London, Birmingham, and as I say, Lichfield would open in 2026. That was the hope 10 years ago. And the rest of the network up to Manchester and Leeds would open in the 2030s, I think around 2033. As things stand today, the assumption, I think, is that phase one and phase 2A, which is our section up from Birmingham to Crewe, will actually open together. And they'll probably open together in about 2033.
And if they decided that they were going ahead with the eastern leg, what is the current timing thought on that?
Well, I think realistically towards 2040, I think that was set out again in the Okavy review.
What stage of construction are we at now? What have we actually built and done?
Well, there's quite significant construction underway on phase one. So there's a very large construction portal just south of the M25, which is the start of the tunnel that will take HS2 under the Chiltern Hills. And that's 16 kilometres of tunnel. So it's very, very long, very significant piece of infrastructure. Construction is well in hand at London Euston, although that is one of the most complex aspects of the entire HS2 project, in my opinion. And there's construction work underway in Birmingham as well. So if you take a train into Birmingham New Street, you'll pass the site of the new Birmingham station, which is Curzon Street, and that's being cleared at the moment.
How was it originally envisaged that HS2 would fit alongside other upgrades to the rail network?
There's been mounting pressure over recent years from policymakers, especially in the Midlands and Northern England, to develop more rail upgrades around Birmingham, around Manchester, around Leeds, including, I think, the most high-profile proposal, which is a new line potentially between Leeds and Manchester called Northern Powerhouse Rail. The government intends to set out how these proposals and these potential future projects will mesh with HS2 and particularly the Eastern Leg later this year when it publishes its integrated rail plan.
Nick Kingsley, So how does HS2, planned some time ago, fit into the developing picture of the country's current transport needs? With me now in the briefing room is Bridget Rosewell, a member of the National Infrastructure Commission. Bridget Rosewell, we've just heard Nick Kingsley refer there to the Integrated Rail Plan. Can you tell me what that is?
The Integrated Rail Plan's a way of trying to pull together all the different pieces of our railway system and our railway investments to try and make sure that they all work effectively together and that we're thinking about pinch points on the existing system, how to make sure it works effectively, as well as new pieces of railway we might invest in, such as reversing some of the beaching cuts, HS2, new lines, all of the above.
Now, what was the original impulse behind wanting an integrated rail plan?
I think there's two bits. One is an increasing realisation that we were thinking about new railway without thinking enough about the existing railway. And the other bit of it was trying to bring together how the trains work and how the track works. The acronym for that, if you like, has been the integration of track and train, to make sure that we're using the existing system in the most effective way possible, maximising the availability of trains for passengers. The system has become very crowded. It's been too successful, amazingly. Too many trains, too many people, too much crowding, and the whole thing's started to creak at the seams.
So we've hit a capacity crunch, and that's why we need an integrated rail plan.
We've hit a capacity crunch, which means we need more railways and we need an integrated rail plan to make sure we deliver the right bits of railway where they're most needed.
OK, we'll come on in a moment to what you think will be in the integrated rail plan. But let's look first at where HS2 fits into it.
HS2 must fit into the integrated rail plan when we get it. And indeed, one of my whinges, if you like, about HS2 at the very beginning is that we didn't think hard enough about how HS2 could fit into the existing system. When it was first thought of back in 2008-09, it was thought of as a kind of almost an independent system, high-speed rail network, not connected to anything else on the system. We've come back from that, I'm glad to say, and now the thinking more recently has been very much about, well, where does HS2 flange into the existing railway? For example, if you go to Scotland, we're not going to necessarily build a high-speed network all the way through, so it'll need to use the existing system to make sure you actually do get a faster train to Scotland. Where does that happen? How does it happen? What's the right place for it to happen? Where's the effectiveness of that? All of those sorts of questions, I think, are really important and weren't thought about hard enough at the beginning.
Is that another way of saying that there were rail priorities that the HS2 plan just simply didn't deal with at all?
Yes, that's absolutely right. When HS2 was first mooted, it was all about speed. And it's not terribly surprising to me that the number of people came back and said, well, what's the point of saving 10 or even 20 minutes off the time getting to Birmingham when it only takes an hour and 10 minutes anyway? Why are we doing that? That's not worth it. The case was made completely the wrong way around. What we actually needed for that, particularly going to Birmingham, was a way of relieving pressure on the existing line, the West Coast Main Line, which was full, impossible to get more trains on, and hard to maintain and close it for long enough to renew track and make sure it was safe.
If you look at the map of HS2, whether you look at the west or the east legs, they are north-south routes. Is it the case that you think that our priorities in rail are north-south?
I don't think that they should be. They should be as much east-west as north-south. And indeed, if you look at the map of the railways in the 19th century, they were focused on track in and out of London. We never really thought hard enough about east-west, and therefore those connections either have been closed, as Oxford to Cambridge was closed, for example, or indeed don't really exist very well, as Birmingham to Derby and Nottingham don't. And indeed, the links between Liverpool, Manchester and Leeds have been really neglected over the decades. So at the National Infrastructure Commission, well, Commissioner, when we did our study of the rail needs for the Midlands and the North, which government asked us particularly to look at, we concluded that the links most in need of investment and as fast as one could do it would be those east-west links.
Okay, now, when the integrated rail plan is finally released, what do you think it's going to say?
I wish I knew. And if I did know, I probably couldn't tell you. So this is mere speculation on my part. I think it will create a set of priorities for immediate work and immediate investment. I think it will identify, I hope, some pinch points on the existing system, but at the same time, identify the longer term financial requirement and the longer term work that needs to be done to improve the system as a whole, some of which we may not have thought about hard enough yet, which includes, for example, the route north from Nottingham, Derby, Toton, up to Sheffield and Leeds, where there's a lot of engineering that needs to be thought about to know how much that would cost and where the best route is, or indeed north from Crewe and Manchester, and what the best way is to accelerate the links up into Scotland. But again, there's work that needs to be done before you could say, okay, this is going to cost whatever billions, this is why it's worth doing, and now make a decision about it.
Bridget Rosewell, that gives us a clear idea of how the infrastructure pieces fit together. But of course, life is not that simple. Gigantic projects attract big interests and grand opinions, never more so than now in the era of the levelling up agenda. How might these impact on the future of HS2? With me in the briefing room are George Parker, political editor at the Financial Times, and Tony Travers, professor in the School of Public Policy at the London School of Economics. Tony Travers, my experience of these great projects is that they tend, after all, to become more than about just the project itself. Is that also true of HS2? I mean, does it symbolise something more than just a fast train service?
I think it symbolises far more than just a fast train service. I mean, in no particular order, particularly I think for the current Prime Minister and one or two other politicians, it's a major statement about the future of the country. It's sort of big thing that, you know, Britain's doing, other countries have done it, we're doing it too. I think that's one thing. It's now, of course, enormously important post-pandemic as a sort of booster for the economy, lots of construction companies, great swathes of supply chains that they have are all dependent upon it. And then last but not least, it's got tangled up in the whole current debate about levelling up, which it didn't start with. So it's got several purposes beyond being a railway.
George Parker, is that broadly how you see it?
Yes, I mean, it was a dream of the last Labour government and then picked up enthusiastically by George Osborne, the former Tory Chancellor. And as Tony says, they looked around Europe, they saw Germany and France with their gleaming new high-speed rail networks. And they thought, you know, surely once in every 150 years, we should be able to build a new railway of our own in this country and not rely on railways built by people in stove hats and smoking pipes. So I think that was part of it. But as Tony said, it's now got tangled up in the whole debate about levelling up. It's a very visible expression of the levelling up agenda. And I think that's quite important because there's been a debate in government about what does levelling up mean? And you speak to some ministers who say the term is so broad that it doesn't actually mean anything at all. And that's why they really want visual symbols of what they're talking about, whether it's having free ports, for example, in places like Teesside, or building a shiny new railway to the north.
Now, George, you've written this week about the likely mothballing of the eastern leg. Insofar as you can judge, what is likely to be the political and other fallout from a decision like that?
That line connects the Midlands and London to a part of the country where the Conservative Party has been doing well recently, in the northeast in particular. And so inevitably there have been complaints about this from Conservative MPs who are lobbying very hard to get the line built. I think there's an acceptance now that that's not going to happen, at least not as originally conceived. And so people are looking now at the best plan B, really, to try to deliver improved rail services to that part of the world.
So in other words, they're going to buy it.
I'm not sure they're going to buy it. They're going to be upset about it. And of course, they're going to be hammered by the Labour Party, because if you delay or mothball or truncate planned routes to that part of the world, the Labour Party will say you're ratting on your promises to the Midlands and the north of England. So it is going to be very tough. And I think the key thing for Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, is to come up with some alternative plans to mitigate the political damage. So whether that's promising to speed up the improvements of rail links across the Pennines between Leeds and Manchester, or building at least part of the eastern leg of the line into the East Midlands, but something, I think, just to try and alleviate the political damage.
Tony Travis, how do you think it's going to work out politically?
Well, there are definitely a number of northern leaders and MPs who will be cheesed off by this, but there are some from smaller town constituencies who have been opposed to it. So the Conservatives have MPs on both sides. You know, the way government works is they will announce, as it were, something better. So it won't be, we're not doing it, it's, we're going to do something better. So we're going to give more control over the resources to civic leaders in the Midlands and the North. We're going to improve east-west rail connection faster, remembering that, you know, this line as currently designed wasn't going to reach Leeds till 2040 at the earliest. So it would be possible to do a lot in a much shorter timescale if money were used differently. And I'm pretty certain the government will describe this as an improvement, not a worsening.
But if part of the reason why, George Parker, you're not going to do this is because of the money, and you're then going to say, but we are going to spend money, it's hard to see what the case argument is, other than that this other thing we're now going to do is better than the thing that we've decided not to do.
Well, I think the Treasury is very focused on delivering things which work, and preferably work within some semblance of the budget. And the reason the Treasury is so concerned about this eastern leg of HS2, which at the moment is scheduled to cost somewhere north of £40 billion, but I was speaking to someone in the government who's saying, frankly, numbers are being plucked out of the air. Scheme isn't really very well developed at all. So there's a lot of concern that you're committing a large amount of money over a long period to a scheme which is covered in uncertainty. And judging from previous experience with HS2, is likely to go well over that £40 billion budget as well. So the Treasury always favours shorter term, more modest fixes that they think would deliver more bang for their buck than grandiose schemes. And Treasury has a track record for this. I think I'm right in saying, Tony, that the Treasury opposed the extension of the Jubilee line out to London Docklands, which obviously proved pivotal in developing that part of the world.
Yeah.
And further back, I think there was a lot of Treasury resistance to building the M25 motorway around London. So they don't like grand projet on the French model. So the idea of improving existing lines, having shorter lines, and developing sort of improvements across the Pennines, I think that's the sort of thing that appeals to Treasury mandarins a lot more than building sort of long-range projects spanning decades, basically.
Tony Travis, it sounds like the Treasury doesn't even like grand projet on the British model.
No, they don't really. And you could say with good reason, because it's almost impossible to keep control over them. We have a past where there are other projects of this kind. Concorde, famously, TSR-2, a fighter plane in the 50s and 60s, which eventually Dennis Healey cancelled. And I think the difficulty is, particularly if they're 100% government funded and they're very big, it's almost impossible to control them and impossible to stop their costs going up and up and up. And obviously, you know, building a better bus network or a metro line in Leeds is going to be much easier to control than this.
Now, that brings us to that question of the outsourcing of this to localities and so on, because you've suggested that the new model that people, the government will want to use, is the idea that somehow we're putting the control of how you improve, exactly what you improve in the transport structure, to the local mayors, to the local authorities.
Yes, remember that in addition to everything else we're talking about, the government is committed to devolution. And it's got a white paper coming out in the autumn that's going to deal with levelling up and devolution. Separately, they had a paper published not that long ago about the future of the railways. So if you bring all of this together, an obvious way of tying everything together would be to say we're now in favour of devolution. And to show that we're really in favour of it, we're going to give more control to mayors and civic leaders in the Midlands and the North to decide how they will use this money. And you can easily see that it will become a devolutionary move as well as changing the configuration of the future of the rail system that doesn't involve a great chunk of HS2.
George, does that work? You could effectively say to people who might otherwise be fed up about the slowness or non-existence of parts of the HS2 project, yeah, but we're going to give you some money so that you can do some extra transport things in your area.
Yes, I think that does appeal to the government for sure. I mean, they've been criticised for going slow on the devolution agenda. And I was speaking to Michael Heseltine the other day, who was a bit of a pioneer of the city mayor idea back in the 90s, actually. And he said that he thought the devolution agenda was dead. So I think the government does need to breathe life back into it. And that means empowering some of these new city, metro, regional mayors and going down the route of empowering local politicians and favouring local projects is something which appeals much more to the Treasury. You have some sort of form of local accountability. Going back to what I was saying earlier, if the Treasury had its way, instead of building high-speed rail lines, it would build a series of local bypasses, which I think deliver a lot more bang for the buck. So going local, I think, although less glamorous, less likely to attract big headlines, I think is the way the government would prefer to go.
Tony Travers, what is the evidence when we look at this concept, levelling up? What is the evidence that projects like these, whichever ones we're talking about, actually succeed in doing that thing, in levelling things up?
Well, the evidence that's been put forward about HS2 and levelling up is pretty mixed. Some academics believe it would indeed help generate jobs and economic activity in cities in the Midlands and the North. Others think it might actually suck more activity down south into London. It's interesting, public opinion is much more in favour of the project for people in the south of the country than the north, complicatedly. So against that backdrop, I think that being certain what this does for levelling up is hard to be certain about and is well off into the future, whereas it would be possible to use some of the money much sooner to deliver real results in the Midlands and the North much, much well before 2040.
Before I come to George on that, I mean, HS2 is HS2. We've had an HS1. Did that succeed in levelling things up along its route at all?
I mean, it doesn't stop very much in Britain. I mean, Ebbsfleet, which is where HS1 stops, hasn't been a massive success. I'm not sure it did a great deal for Ashford. So along that line through to Paris, not much evidence, I think, that it radically altered the economies of the places in Kent.
The Chancellor's obviously going to say, if the decision goes the way, George, that you're anticipating, which is that we do mothball the eastern leg of HS2, that, frankly, given the state of public finances, pandemic, etc., we can't afford this now, but we might be able to do in the future. If we can make a judgment about how people are likely to react to that, aren't most people likely to say, yeah, that's fair enough? Or are there very big holdouts and political risks which he's running?
Well, I think the broader political risk the Chancellor's running looking ahead to the autumn is the sense that he is tightening the purse strings in a way which runs counter to the government's big rhetoric on levelling up. And I think that is the big sort of political story of the autumn, really, the fact that the Chancellor is now trying to restore order to the public finances after the chaos caused by COVID. And the Prime Minister wants to spend more money. Now, HS2 is one thing, but again, this week we had an example of Conservative MPs in the North saying that the government should maintain its uplift universal credit, £20 a week, also as part of the levelling up agenda. That's something that Rishi Sunak wants to scrap in the autumn. So there are a whole load of things relating to levelling up where Rishi Sunak is going to be sort of really trying, not returning to austerity, the government's ruled that out, but basically trying to stick to existing promises, not add to things that they've already said. And coupled with that, there is now sort of a backlash from Southern MPs who want a bit of the action as well. You had the Tory MP for Guildford suggesting that it'd be nice to have a £1 billion tunnel under Guildford, on the Guildford bypass. There's a lot of pressure on the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And this decision on HS2 and to delay or truncate the eastern leg, I think it's just a part of a broader picture that we're going to see playing out this autumn.
Guildford, not exactly part of the Red Wall. Tony Travers, is there also a problem that the overall benefit of the entire scheme can be significantly diminished of the part that you do build if you don't build the other part?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the benefit to cost ratio, which the government is less committed to than it used to be, but nevertheless is still an important issue. It was always the best benefit to cost ratio was always on the assumption that the whole thing was built. And if you don't build some of it, the benefit to cost ratio on the rest of it gets worse.
Explain.
Well, there's the cost of building the railway, and then there are a whole range of benefits which are much debated, I might add, about how you calculate them in the sort of economist's way of looking at a project and comparing one with another. The Treasury was always very fond of this. The government as a whole less so now because it sees it that using cost-benefit ratios as a way of justifies more building in the south of England than the north. So the Treasury is trying to push away from it a little bit. But with HS2, the way that the calculations were done suggested that if it was all built, that the benefits were greater than if only part of it's built in relation to the cost of building whatever it is you do build.
Tony Travers there with George Parker. And I suppose we have to conclude that around 2033, trains will be whizzing between London, Birmingham, Manchester. But the prospect of Leeds, Nottingham and Derby being high-speed connected by 2040 is very much moot. My thanks to Bridget Rosewell, Nick Kingsley, Tony Travers and George Parker. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Sharon Hemans. The sound was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've asked who's supporting the Taliban, how much will COP26 help tackle climate change, and what's next for Joe Biden's foreign policy.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.